mobile phone scam called SIM swapping.
This was one of the largest data breaches in history.
We are playing fast and loose with our data.
It's important to understand the sheer scale here.
Surveillance capitalism is driven to shape and influence our behavior.
It's just kind of a shrug, like, well, what can you really do?
You're listening to Signal Jam, a privacy podcast for everyone. I'm Michael.
And I'm Jay.
Today, we are very pleased and excited to host Josh on the show. Josh is a refreshingly down-to-earth voice in the privacy space, and a very knowledgeable one at that. You might know him from his YouTube channel, Side of Burritos, with episodes about various privacy and security-related topics, which he masterfully balances with wisdom, practicality, and his signature dry sense of humor. You may have also heard him hosting the podcast In the Shell, with stories about hackers, malware, hardware, and influential tech people. And he's also the founder of Yellow Ball, a privacy-respecting podcast hosting service, which we are glad to support and host Signal Jam on. Josh, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm eager to hear more about how you came to start the projects that others probably best know you for, but I kind of want to start the conversation by talking a bit about your origin story, if you will. Whenever I meet someone in the privacy space, I'm always excited to understand their personal journey to it. So talk a little bit about yours and how you got started.
Yeah, I was thinking about this a little bit earlier because I kind of get asked this question often and never know what exactly to say. But the main moment I can remember is probably back in college. This was at this point 14, 15 years ago, if I remember correctly. And at this time, Facebook was pretty popular. Everyone was on there. Everyone was sharing. And one of my close friends at the time, we were sitting in the back of one of our security classes one day. And we're both thinking like, wow, you know, we're into security. We're going to be entering the workforce soon. Why are we doxing ourselves like this? I mean, everyone's doing it. But
so true.
Should we really be doing this? And that one day we both just deleted our Facebooks. And that was kind of the first step into, let me try and reduce my footprint on the internet and take a step back, reevaluate, and kind of go from there.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's fair, honestly. Yeah, it's just... And so we often compare privacy to a marathon rather than a sprint. It feels like the destinational goalpost is constantly changing. How would you describe where you feel you're at in that marathon? Are there areas you feel you've got a good bearing, or maybe goals you still feel just out of reach?
So definitely it is a marathon. But I guess kind of going back to the very beginning and kind of where it's at now, since it is a marathon, I think the first step can be the scariest because, let's see, deleting Facebook. After that, I think I deleted my Indeed, eventually my LinkedIn. And I think the term now that's popular is FOMO. I had this FOMO of missing out on job opportunities, missing out on friends, missing out on, you know, just keeping in touch with people. But that never happened. And in the marathon of privacy and security, it's kind of been reassuring that it's been, the choices have been good. They've been beneficial, especially seeing what comes out in the news, things like that. Yeah, I don't know. It's just been trying to do more and more every year. And I don't know, kind of almost forgot the question, but hopefully that answers it a bit.
No, I think you nailed it.
Yeah. Are there maybe strategies or techniques or tools you want to change or implement in the near future to kind of maybe get further along that path?
What I'm focusing on now, I say focusing, really it's just in my mind, haven't actually done anything on it yet, but email hosting. I've stayed away from self-hosting it for a while. I used to in the past. I had a VPS set up, but maintaining an IP reputation when it comes to email can be a pain. Mm. Especially in a VPS, you get a random IP address. It ends up on block lists. You're constantly wondering, am I missing an email because I'm on a block list? Did someone not get my email? So I've sort of shied away from doing it. But over the last year or so, I've kind of migrated from Proton to Tuda. Then one day I found out that I was missing emails because Tuda was rate limiting one of the IP addresses that was sending me emails. I reached out to them. They kind of gave me a half-baked answer. And I was kind of just, I don't know. It made me really want to kind of take control of it again. So I do want to start looking into that again. I'll still use, you know, public email relays for actually sending email. So I'm not maintaining that, but kind of taking things back into my control. You know, self-hosting your own email, you get more access to filters that you can use. You can see all the raw logs versus the masked service, things like that. So that's the main one I'm thinking about working on next.
Sounds like a laborious task, that's for sure. But I feel like the eventual outcome's beneficial, definitely.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a labor of love because it's kind of just a pain to do. So
that's definitely going to be it. Yeah. I'd say from our end, I know I'm trying to shift more to self-hosting as well, whether that's, you know, the basic stuff or, God forbid, I ever get around to doing email. That's definitely low on my to-do list, maybe. So it's definitely admirable. I'd love to do that, but it's sounds like a commitment I'm not quite ready for yet.
Let's talk about your first foray into privacy content and where most people likely first saw you, your YouTube channel, Side of Burritos. I'm curious, what was happening around that point in your life that pushed you to enter the content space, and what were you hoping to accomplish with the channel?
So funny enough, I was talking to someone about this yesterday who also posts content online. We're kind of talking about how we got started. And my channel, when it first got started, actually had financial videos on it, kind of like personal finance, how to invest, things like that. I was going to be doing some trading on Robinhood because that was the cool thing to do in 2020.
Nice.
All those videos are hidden at this point, if you look back.
Okay.
I then started getting into some crypto. So I had some crypto mining videos. They were pretty corny, but a lot of people watched the videos and set it up on their computers. And at that point, I was kind of getting tired of YouTube. It is tough to get started on YouTube unless you find an audience that actually wants to watch you. Mm. And this, to me, felt kind of like grifting what I was doing in a way.
Okay, interesting.
So Apple published how they were going to start scanning photos locally on your phone. I had an iPhone at the time.
Mm.
I did not like it whatsoever. Once that came out, that was kind of like my breaking point. And so I started looking for some alternatives, came across Graphene OS, installed it on my phone, and I was like, huh, wonder if other people can benefit from a calm, thorough installation video. It was, you know, it's pretty straightforward using the web interface, but you might have some hesitancy, especially if you've never used like tech before. So I'm like, let me see if people might like this, demonstrate the process, put it out there, and people liked it. So I ran with it.
That's actually one of the first videos I watched of yours. And I remember thinking that straight to the point, no fluff, straight to the point. And for me, that's kind of, I want the bare bones of something. I want to just do a task. I don't want to, you know, there's always like the paid promotion, this unnecessary spiel. It's a bit like one of those blog posts that has, you know, skip to the bottom to get to the recipe. I just want to get the results. And I've always found your videos very clean, straight to the point.
Yeah.
And it's always been enjoyable to watch, which I love that.
Yeah, that was my goal from the start, kind of just getting that straightforward concept that you understand. And my other issue is, you know, I've been in tech for a while. So before AI, you Google around, you find a Stack Overflow post that tells you, follow these instructions or tutorial. And they're always missing like three assumed steps. And I hated doing that. And I'm just like, how much time do I need to waste to figure out your tutorial for you that you could have documented? So for me, I'm like, let me just do it live, show you. If I miss something, it's because the process changed, not because I forgot to include it or intentionally left it out. So that was my other annoyance for starting that kind of content like that.
What have you found most insightful about the topics you've discussed and the research for your channel?
So I'd say the biggest realization I've come to is, maybe this is why I started it this way from the beginning, but once you're in a field for a long time, you just assume other people understand the basics, or the basics to you just seem easy. And that is not the case. You know, I'll get questions from people or do like some phone calls, consultations. And they're asking me questions that I assume everyone knows, like something about Android permissions. I'm like, oh, it's just long press on the app, go to app info and click it. They're like, oh, I didn't even know this was there. So it's just kind of those realizations of, you know, the basics are a great place to start because a lot of people don't know them, and that's what they're looking for, especially the ones that want to get involved. The people that know the basics, they have their strong opinions already, which they make vocal. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What I thought was kind of interesting looking at your channel was how, like your highest viewed videos varied by topics. Like I think your top three videos were about Graphene OS and how you configure Brave browser, and then your personal preferred alternatives to F-Droid. Is there anything about releasing the content that you have that's kind of taken you by surprise as far as what people tend to gravitate towards or what they latch onto more?
I've always said I should look into this so I can know what videos to make, but then I get lazy, find a topic that's interesting, I just make a video on it. But it almost seems like you're at like a dice table. It's like, let me just see what works. Throw something out there and it's like, wow, okay. People were interested in Brave browser settings. Like I did not think that was going to be an interesting video, but like you said, I think that's one of the top viewed videos for some reason.
I think it's always kind of shocking to see what people do find interesting. And, you know, you might find some other topic particularly fascinating. You release that information to people and they're like, yeah, they're indifferent. But then you'll do this, you know, what you feel is a basic kind of topic, and so many people flock towards that, which again, I guess boils down to that people sometimes don't know the basics, and those assumptions we made were, you know, based on the premises everyone else knew those things already. So maybe it is that appeal of like, oh, someone's telling us what we want to know, as opposed to something that they're interested in and the assumptions they've made about us.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty accurate. And it's also like going back to the basics, I've noticed that contents I put out that's kind of, I'm not gonna say ranting, but kind of just sharing some thoughts, stuff like that does well initially. But the, I guess, evergreen content that kind of picks up for a while is like the guides, things like that, kind of those long form things, you know, like your intro episodes you did on kind of the basics of privacy. Those ones have carried on for a long time, I found.
I feel like maybe it also comes down to, again, the fact that the space is constantly evolving. So a new tutorial could have something that we didn't already know, or, you know, it could just be one situation or one update that, you know, oh, now you've enabled this as well, and this results in you having to do this now too. And then suddenly it's like, oh, these tutorials, again, like from years back, no longer apply. So I feel like maybe that's why there's always that draw to those kind of 101s or basics, kind of back to basic content, is because of the space constantly changing.
Yeah, you can kind of apply it to everything versus my love hate I have with my videos where, you know, it's out of date in 6 months and I'm like, oh, I'm glad I put all that work into that I can't edit and go back and change. You know, but the basics kind of always you can update and apply to your life.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Yeah, we've even talked about that too with respect to some of the things that were coming out in the news, like almost in real time, either straight before or straight after we'd record an episode. We're like, wow, okay, you know, how do we, like, do we even bother addressing this, or do we just like redo these next year and then we'll talk about it then and reassess, you know?
We did discuss briefly, I think, you know, supplemental kind of episodes saying, you know, whilst you were sleeping, this is what happened, and, you know, this particular VPN provider or something like that. But again, I think Michael probably had the right idea in terms of like, we'll update in a year because there's going to be a lot of this change by that point.
Yeah. I was, even recently, I made a video on the Graphene OS Motorola partnership and I was procrastinating, which was good because the initial video I was going to film was how there's this mysterious company they're going to partner with. And then 2 days later, it's like, hey, they're partnering. So I'm just like, this stuff changes so quick. How do you even keep up and make stuff about it?
Yeah, I used to have a tech ed teacher in middle school that would always joke. He'd say, what ages faster, a computer or a ham sandwich? Which I think is a great point to make. Everything does change so fast, you know. Well, before I ask my next question, I got to ask, tell us about the name, Side of Burritos. Is there a connection to tech or privacy there? Was that inspired by something else?
It was inspired by, I really like .coms, and it's hard to find a .com domain. I also like burritos. I think it's superior to a taco. And I was like, oh, Side of Burritos. And I'm like, oh, the .com's available. Cool. And then it turned out where you can call a newsletter Burrito Bowl, and then you can call a podcast In the Shell. Kind of has that double naming.
Love that. That's awesome. Never even made that connection.
That's clever.
Yeah. That's awesome.
No, I didn't make that connection either. That's brilliant. And I agree. Burritos are superior.
Yep. Exactly. Besides that, nothing behind it.
Fair enough. Are you like a bean and meat kind of burrito fan, or is it just one or the other?
Bean, cheese, and throw everything else on top.
Like it. I like that a lot. Yeah. Well, okay. So speaking of your YouTube channel, starting and maintaining a YouTube channel with over 27,000 subscribers now at this point is quite an accomplishment, but then deciding to build on that success by launching a podcast is a whole other level of commitment. So tell us about why you decided to pivot in that direction and produce In the Shell.
That's a good question. I'm kind of blanking actually on that answer right now. Yeah, I think I was just looking to branch out a little bit. So it might be apparent on camera on my videos, but I'm not really comfortable filming videos, and it's takes a lot of work to film a video and edit it, and it's kind of just draining and exhausting. And I was like, hey, you know, audio is a little bit easier. I don't need to try and make a cut to make it look like I didn't stop and re-record this section. And it was more just a a way to get something out there that maybe people could listen to on their phone or in their car instead of just the sit down, watch the video, here's something techie to follow, a tutorial. More of the entertainment side of things instead of the tutorial side. So I guess that was the main reason behind it and kind of why I started that.
Yeah. I think your style, your choice of content was interesting too, because I feel like around the time that you launched the podcast was sort of in the aftermath of Michael Bazell deciding to leave the podcast, at least temporarily, on hiatus. And so, I'll speak for myself, but I've also run into other people in the community that were searching for something to kind of fill that gap. And so when you first launched the podcast, I listened to the first episode, I was like, that was not what I was expecting at all. But it was really great. It was very entertaining. It was like, I feel like you did a really nice job transposing your style from YouTube and adapting that for an audio format. And then, bringing in topics that, were kind of privacy adjacent, but very engaging.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it was a gap that I do think needs filling in that area, especially with you guys coming out with your show as well. So it was kind of the thing where I'm like, hey, Michael, he's kind of the top tier sort of personality currently publishing episodes. I guess might be time to step in and put some other content out there and see. I also like the idea behind podcasts where here's a file, listen to it. If you have an opinion that you want to share, I'm not the biggest fan of YouTube comments. There's some nasty people in there, I guess, to say the least. With podcasts, if you want to tell me what you really think, you need to go find my email, email me. You actually took the time. Maybe you thought that your comment's not worth actually saying to someone. So I also like that aspect of it.
Gives them more time to reflect on whether or not it's worth putting it out there.
Exactly. That's where I think podcasts kind of shine in that regard, at least from a mental stability standpoint. So that's the other reason for the podcast.
Yeah. You recently wrapped up season 3. Congratulations. I believe you mentioned you have something a bit different in mind for the next season. Can you maybe tease us with a hint and when we'll hear from you again?
I bounce around with the ideas I want to do. I was debating on doing some interviews for season 4. The other thing I want to do, I've been kicking this around for a long time, but unfortunately it's one of those things where if I don't find anything, it might not be interesting, but trying to figure out a way to frame it. But that's kind of going through the entire VPN ecosystem and researching what's behind it. Mm. Because there's been a lot of consolidation. There's been a lot of sketchiness. There's just different stuff. So I might do some episodes on that, but maybe also frame it around some OSINT techniques and kind of discuss those.
Oh, nice.
Some different tools, how to find some businesses, their registrations, people behind them, the who is stuff. Look at how their websites operate and see, are there patterns behind them? So, maybe Nord's not associated with XYZ company over here, but they have the same coding patterns behind it. So maybe there is something overlaying, even though they say they're not, stuff like that. So I've been kicking that idea around.
That would definitely be interesting. I'd be down to listen to that for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Almost like a true crime, except more of a true VPN sort of thing. So
that's amazing. Yeah. Here's kind of an off the cuff question. I'm sort of thinking, I was reviewing your website and noticed that you had made a comment about being open to sponsors, but that you were trying to avoid, I think, tech emphasized or tech focused companies. What's the motivation behind that? And who's an example of a company that you think would be fun to have a kind of a partner in this process with?
So that one came because I find the VPN space very muddy. I'm trying to think of a good word for it. The only sponsor I'd ever take for a VPN is Malvad, and they don't sponsor anyone. So, okay, that's how that goes. But I feel like being in tech, it's really hard to take tech sponsors and then say you speak openly and accurately about it. Like, oh, they sent me this free product, but I'm giving you my honest opinion. You're still slighted a little bit if you didn't pay for it in some direction. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, I was like, hey, if some cool snack company that I like or some energy drink company wants to sponsor, fine. I have no loyalty to that'll skew my tech opinions. So that was kind of where I was going at with that.
Yeah, that seems like a wise kind of compartmentalization, just avoiding the chaos altogether and not necessarily having to get in the weeds of being accused of, like you said, misrepresenting something. And you can still, potentially in the end, kind of promote a cool product, but none of the hassle that comes associated with that. That's a great idea.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure anything burrito related would be down for a sponsorship, right?
I'd be great for that one. Give me a free burrito. I'll give you a shout out. Perfect.
Well, I think when you announced your podcast, I think you said that it was in part responsible for Yellow Ball too. What was going through your mind as you were looking for a provider to host your show?
Inherently, podcasts are private. There is an RSS feed, and there is a list of files on the back end that your client looks at and says, hey, here's the location of that file. Sync it to the device, download it, stream it, one of the two. There's inherently, with a traditional podcast app, not including Spotify or Apple, there's no analytics. You can't see where someone paused an episode. You can't see that someone stopped listening. You just see they downloaded a file or parts of a file. And there, that was something I really liked about it. Like, wow, there's just so much privacy built into podcasting. And then I started looking at the providers out there and I'm like, okay, everyone wants an email. Everyone wants a credit card. Everyone wants to have some just, there was a lot of these features for promoting and integration with YouTube and integration with this and that, that I understand from a promotional point of view, but also like mental health when trying to run something you're going to put out there. I didn't think were like the healthiest things where, oh, here's an award because you posted 4 weeks in a row. Okay, well, I just want to post on my own schedule. There's just these weird features where I wasn't a huge fan of them. And I'm like, let me try and put something out there that others might like that I'm looking for and see how it goes.
These podcast hosting providers monetize engagement with their platform. You know, you're pumping out another episode. Oh, look, here's a gold star for doing that, which only makes you, you know, put more effort, more strain on yourself to get out the content that maybe, as you say, you wanted to release on your own schedule. And by the end of it, you're just feeling that mental baggage even more, I think, which I can definitely understand wanting to not deal with that.
Yeah, because I've had a lot of experience with that from YouTube. YouTube is notorious for you post a video and there's a list of your top 10 and they will quickly tell you, oh, your video is 10 out of 10. You know, it's not doing as well. It's just, and if you get a 1 out of 10, they give you little fireworks that show up. So it's like, wow, look, I did well. Let me post more. I'm just like, I don't want the machine to manipulate me. So let me build a podcast hosting that if people want to post, they post. If they don't, they don't.
So would you say that's when you realized Yellowball could be more of than just a solution for your own podcast hosting?
Yeah, initially I had some ideas on, hey, let me just manually build an RSS feed. I'll host it on a static site generator. People can download it from there. I'll do some manual editing. Then I'm like, hey, you know, I've always wanted to build a SaaS app or just an app in general. I find coding is interesting, but I find the architecture behind a platform way more interesting. You know, what database we're going to use, what backend, what front end, how we're going to structure the design of the site, how will scheduled tasks be handled, how we're going to structure the data, things like that. So this is kind of the opportunity for me to force myself to get into it. I'm very bad at studying and watching guides and build this tutorial. It's like, let me just bite off way more than I can chew, try and build it and see how it goes.
So with all that in mind, has your experience been, I guess, has it been smooth sailing or rough seas since you launched Yellowball?
It's been good. what a powerful word to use in the description. So it was very nerve-wracking at first because putting something out there for people to use. Now, you know, I self-host at home. I have health checks that run externally to see if my stuff goes down so I can go fix it. Now I have a service that if it goes down, someone else cares besides myself and they're, you know, paying me for it. So there's some, you know, agreement there that it's going to be up. So that was always kind of stressful in the beginning. Like, hey, I'm seeing this, or I got an alert that there was an error generated. Okay, did someone type in something that was incorrect or did my code cause a bug? So in the beginning, it was a little bit choppy, kind of working through bugs, things like that. But now I have it at a good point where I only get woken up maybe once or twice every 6 months because Hetzner, which is the hosting provider I use, has a issue and I get a health alert in the middle of the night. But besides that, it's been good. A good learning experience.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, just as like from a customer perspective, I think you've been fantastic to work with. Every time I had an idea or a misunderstanding or just a question in general, you were very prompt. And I was actually always pleasantly surprised when I would just like throw a random idea at you and then 2 weeks later in the changelog, there it is, you know, and boom, now you can use it, you know. And I thought your Monero integration was amazing. You just asked for a couple screenshots of invoices and how that worked. And then I'm sure it wasn't magic. It was a lot of hard work and blood and sweat and tears, I'm sure, but certainly felt like magic from our perspective.
No, glad to hear that. It's funny because the jobs I've worked in the past have been at large companies and I would work in different SOCs or security operations centers there. And part of my role was speaking with customers when they're either under attack, their website's down, they need rules put in place, kind of like their oh crap moments, when they're like, hey, the hair's on fire, we need to figure this out, we don't know what's happening. So it kind of transitioned very well to handling customer service, I would say, to a point. Like, I know what people look for, I know what they write in tickets, I know what they want to communicate, or kind of the user experience they're looking for. So that was also very helpful, which a lot of fields in tech, I don't think you get that experience of direct customer interaction on the phone every single day. So stuff like that's helped a lot.
It's all bots these days, all bots, chat bots and help bots. Exactly. And I'm like, I want to talk to a human. Is that so much to ask?
What a concept.
Well, looking into the future, how do you see Yellow Ball evolving to stay competitive while also staying privacy respecting?
So it's tough because I'm not going to say it's a saturated space podcast hosting, but it's kind of saturated with the hosts out there. So definitely need to work on some marketing, kind of just putting features out there that I see are popular or ones that I want to use. So that's kind of been a big part of it, kind of just maintaining it, making it easy to use, reaching out to people hosting existing shows, showing them, hey, you know, you come over here, it's better, more affordable, and got the same features or more. So I guess things like that.
Has that strategy worked for you at all in terms of, you know, gently poaching people into a better platform?
For a few, it's worked out pretty well so far, especially since when it comes to marketing, especially now, you can't just post and hope that you're number one on Google or people pay for marketing on there, which I refuse to do. So I kind of go back to, what do I know and what can I do well? So one of the strategies I was using was scraping a bunch of feeds from other providers, getting the emails out of those, and then reaching out to those customers because it's all public. I'm like, hey, I know how to scrape stuff. I know how to do this. So I'm kind of using my strengths that I know and kind of cold emailing, whether or not that's ethical. You know, it's emailing people. I don't know. But so that's what I've been doing, and it's been working pretty well.
That's awesome. Glad to hear it. Something else I wanted to ask you is, you've referenced the approach that Start9 used by starting off closed source and then gradually opening up their software stack as they matured into their eventual MIT open source licensing. I'm curious why that model appealed to you, and do you still feel like it's the right approach after a couple of years in business?
With that, yes. I'd say the main reason for that is, one, that was one of the first apps I ever wrote, like big apps. So it's kind of like posting on YouTube for the first time, releasing your code is kind of like, hey guys, come look at what I got here. And it's kind of embarrassing. So that was one way to kind of go behind it. With future stuff, because I'm actually working on something else now, a different app, that one I plan to just release FOSS from the beginning. So I think it really depends on what it's going for. With Yellow Ball, I think it works well because podcasts are inherently public. You know, this episode is going to be a file online. Everything you enter in the site, 99% of it is public information anyways that you're going to be sharing. So to me, I'm like, that's not as big of a deal. The new thing I'm working on, which is going to be end-to-end encrypted, you can't just trust me that it's working. So to me, a FOSS model fits better for that versus something like podcast hosting, where I think the closed to open can work better.
Sure. Well, now you've got me really curious. Are you at liberty or at all interested in teasing us a little bit more about what you're trying to end-to-end encrypt here?
Yeah, so it's going to be called Salted Harbor. If you want to check it out, it's saltedharbor.com. The app hasn't launched yet, but it has some details on it. So I don't know if you've ever heard of EddySync before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's cool. I do like it. I'm not going to say it's abandoned, but it's not very much maintained currently at this point from what I've seen. Also, to self-host it, it could be kind of a beast to self-host. You know, it has a very large, there's no easy Docker container with it. I had some issues when self-hosting it that kind of freaked me out a little bit. So I always wanted to have, let me back up a little bit more. I currently use Radical self-hosting my contacts, but that is not end-to-end encrypted. It works really well. It has zero web interface though, which I don't like. I wanted a really nice interface for contacts and calendar. EddySync has that, but again, it's not a great one. So for a long time, I wanted to build an end-to-end encrypted contact calendar events and eventually tasks kind of self-hosted / SaaS app. So that's what this is going to be.
Very cool. That's impressive and exciting.
That'd be great to have a replacement for EdiSync. Much like you, I noticed it wasn't being maintained as much as I'd have liked. And I think last time I tried to do it, I just had too many issues setting it up. So it sounds like that's going to be a great replacement. So yeah, no, I'm excited for that.
Yeah, I'm really excited for it. It's been a lot of fun to make because it's a whole different thing from YellowBall, because now you have to deal with, okay, password doesn't leave the user's machine in their browser. How do we handle the encrypted blobs in the database? What database do we use? I'm also going to offer a hosted version that you can pay for. So how does that scale? But how to also make it easy for you to self-host if you want to. It's going to be a simple Docker container for that. But when it comes to end-to-end encryption, you can't just simply connect to it from the Android contacts app or calendar app. You need to have an intermediary Android app now that logs into the app, into the backend, decrypts the contacts, advertises them to Android. So there's been a lot of moving parts. And again, like YellowBall, where I was like, oh, it's just a podcast hosting. It should be a couple months of work. And now with this, I'm like, wow, there's 300 different moving parts. You can't troubleshoot the database if a user has an issue. How is this going to go? And so it's, it's been a lot, but really cool. And so far it's been working well.
I think you just raised an interesting point. Maybe you can say more about this. I have noticed, very, very generally speaking, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush here, but I've noticed that many open source softwares tend not to have necessarily an emphasis on the user experience, which I think, depending on your level of tech literacy or your proficiency or those kinds of things, your skill level, that may not necessarily be a concern. It may not be an inhibition to using the software. However, when it comes to having your friends and family adopt something, user interface, I think, is an experience, for that matter, is sort of become like top of mind for a lot of people, because all the apps that they use in their mainstream app stores are highly polished. So I'm kind of curious, from your perspective, as you're planning and developing this app, how are you shaping it with those sort of design standards in mind?
To me, that's one of the biggest parts. One, because I don't like to use an ugly app. Two, I also find interface design very fascinating, because if you log into something, like if we take Apple, for example, and you're like, wow, this is so basic, it just click here, goes there, it just works. Intentional interfaces like that are simple and easy to use are extremely hard to make. It's very easy just to bolt on a new button that, hey, can you give me this functionality? Sure, here, click this button. Here's another button. Click here. But to have something intentional and, you know, could give it to my mom and be like, log in, set it up. Oh, she was able to do that. Perfect. To me, that's a huge thing I'm going for, to make it so it's easy to use and just a pleasure to use, where you don't have to feel special to use it.
I like that.
Definitely like that too. I think in some regards, I do like some apps that have, you know, it feels like a great degree of granular control. But at the same time, when you're recommending it to someone else, you just want it to work for them. You don't have to be, you know, on call for tech support 24/7 because they've done some misconfiguration somewhere. I think recently I was talking to a friend about this, and they were saying how it seems so complicated. I'm like, it's set and forget. Just click this button, click this button, click this button. Oh, and this one here. Make sure you configure this. And like, by the end of it, I'm like, hang on a minute. This wasn't easy for them, and I can't imagine for many people that is, but that, you know, that one click functionality just to get the outcome they want, it is, as you say, it must be complicated, but it also, the end result is something people want to engage with. Someone will want to open that app and say, this was just an easy alternative to the more, I guess, usually the more privacy invasive options.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going for, am going for. I agree with as well. I think a thing that helped me a lot is one of the companies I used to work for, they had a very large free user base. So their methodology was, we do offer support for free plans, but our products should be intuitive enough where they don't need to come to us. If they're coming to us, it's because there's a real problem the user can't fix. And if we find something where it's like, hey, how do I do this? Okay, fix the interface so that they don't need to email us again, because it just makes for a better support experience and a better experience for the user. So that's kind of what I focus on as well, where if I have to wonder where something is, then it's in the wrong spot. It should be intuitively where you go, it's there. And the other thing I'm going to do, which I saw in another app, I forget which one, is I definitely want to focus on the simplicity and easy user interface, but I'm also adding a feature where, let's say you click on a contact, at the bottom it says encrypted data on server. If you expand it, it makes an API query, fetches the raw encrypted data from the server, so that the nerdy techie people can be like, hey, this is what's on the server directly. Oh. I'm seeing the decrypted stuff in my browser, but here's what he's actually storing on the server. So kind of blend that together.
That I like that. That's super cool. That's exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited for that one. It looks pretty cool, gotta say.
Well, I can't wait to take a look after this. Yeah. Do you have a timeline for when it'll go live?
I always say soon, TM. So, you know, 2-3 months would be nice, but the next part is kind of building out the billing in a way similar to how Malved decouples their credit card payments from the actual account payments. So I went through their documentation, read how they do it. So once I build that out, finish the Android app, make sure it's reliable and that everything looks good, then kind of push it out from there. And then deal with the feedback of publishing code publicly and see how that goes.
Let's maybe reflect or review and talk about privacy more broadly. The privacy landscape today is shifting pretty rapidly, and I'm sure we're all curious for your take. From the perspective of how we engage in privacy today, what do you see out there that gives you hope and optimism for the future, and maybe what keeps you up at night?
I'll try and start with the hope and optimism, because I think the what keeps me up at night is much easier to do, the doom and gloom. The hope, I would say, is it does seem like almost every day there's something new to, maybe not every day, but there's still a lot of options out there and things that I can still do to improve my privacy and security. Mm. So it gives me hope that we're not at the end of the road where everything's locked down. You must follow this exact path laid out by some company. There's still a lot of options. There's stuff I can do. And it seems like there's a lot of people also interested in it. And, you know, the feedback I get on YouTube, the positive stuff, there's a lot of people that do want to pursue it. And they're kind of seeing some of the negative stuff out there and realizing they can do something about it. So that is kind of giving me hope. As far as doom and gloom, the stuff happening in the physical world has me worried a lot. I can get a VPN at my house. I can self-host my data. I can get a burner laptop. I can go on tour. I can do whatever I want anonymously. I can navigate as anonymous as I want to online. But the second I get in my car, there's now 10 different cameras. There's a flock camera. Mm. There is the police car's license plate scanners. The toll people also have them. Maybe a couple months ago, I parked in a parking lot, typed in my number in the little machine that gives you a ticket to pay for parking, typed in my phone number or my license plate number wrong, got an automated ticket in the mail and to my email that said, hey, we noticed your license plate did not pay for parking.
Whoa.
Turns out I just typed it in wrong. So I'm like, oh, wow, they have license plate readers here too. That's cool.
That's terrifying.
Crazy.
Yeah, so stuff like that. And apparently they're integrating them with the DMV because they know my address and everything else.
Right.
So the physical world has me worried, especially with how many cameras are in just going to the grocery store or everywhere. Now you have Meta glasses people are wearing around, apparently, where they are recording everything in the real world. And yeah.
I
don't know what's next.
No, that is definitely one of those things where, you know, nowadays you feel like, I don't want to say if you feel more paranoid or less paranoid, but you'd certainly feel more aware of what's around you in terms of cameras. You know, anytime you see someone wearing glasses, you think, are they Meta glasses? like should I be paying attention a little more now? And that is terrifying. Even in Australia, we're finding, you know, more cameras here and there, more systems automated, where, you know, just one wrong move, one wrong button, one wrong number, and, you know, you're caught up in something you had no intention of being caught up in. It's just, and it feels like it, at least in Australia, it feels like it's rolling out, and it feels like people aren't paying nearly enough attention to it, which is just as terrifying, if not more terrifying.
Yeah. I think the line between what's real and physical in the world and then what's digital is getting kind of blurry kind of fast. Like, you know, to your point, Josh, I've also noticed a ton of cameras in the area that I live in, especially flock cameras. In fact, there's just the other day I was walking around town and saw that there's some people out there protesting about it, and they want, you know, ballot petitions, and they're trying to raise awareness. And so there's, you know, it's encouraging in the one sense that there's a bit of backlash to it and some awareness about it in general, but it is getting kind of crazy. Like there's just surveillance and tracking everywhere.
It's interesting to find the line as well, because people will upload their data to Google, Facebook, whatever, publish it, share photos. They don't really seem to care. It does seem like the backlash to this physical surveillance, where it's like, hey, they're tracking license plate numbers across state lines. They can search for you anywhere in the United States. it seems like that's starting to find a hard line for some people that never used to care.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an interesting thing to watch as well.
Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think that's a good segue to my next question. And it has to deal with some politics. And, you know, we kind of announced this in the last episode. But from my perspective, politics is undeniably influencing privacy. And that's whether through legislative changes or corporate decisions or cultural perceptions. And at the same time, though, I personally sense some reticence within even the privacy space to broach topics that might be politically tinted. So I'm curious, how do you think that we as privacy enthusiasts and privacy advocates should respond to this kind of paradoxical moment?
I was thinking about this a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that I find interesting about it is reading some older magazines that are out there from privacy groups, things like that. I forget the exact one that I was checking out. But even if you go to DEF CON, things like that, there's always this counterculture movement, kind of this anarchist push, kind of like we're making things our own way, we're doing it how we want. So I never understood, I don't know if it's because privacy is reaching a larger audience, that it seems to become this political divide almost in how things are going. And I'm like, well, the original people that did this, they were against anything related to government surveillance, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was never a partisan issue. They were always just, we're doing our own thing. Here's why we're doing it. Here's what we're doing. I don't know. I kind of forgot the question at this point, but that's
that's okay. Well, I mean, say more about that. You know, like, where do you find, you said earlier that it's interesting to find the line and see what resonates with people. Where do you think that line is shifting to now? And maybe how do you activate, you know, something I was talking to Jay about, and I've talked to other people about, is I think for some people who get into the privacy space, it's kind of like there was a dormant value that was just there for a long time. And it took a circumstance or maybe somebody to shine a light on it. And then it was all of a sudden activated again and you remembered it. And it was very clear and you kind of took the steps quite quickly. And for other people, it does take a fair bit of persuasion to kind of get them around to see the different context and the nuances to these arguments and why there are certain things that we should draw lines around and say that's unacceptable, right? So how do you think, you know, what's your thoughts on that sort of generally speaking, as far as how to bring more people into the fold or into the tent? How do you activate that value within people?
My opinion for a long time, it's tough because I'd say I don't really have any suggestions on that. Because my thing was privacy as it is and security, you got to really commit if you want to do it. If you're going to step outside the press one button, sign into account, everything magically works.
Mm-hmm.
You need to really want to do it. That's one reason I never put out videos to try and, well, one, I don't like the whole fear mongering, but I never put out stuff there trying to persuade people into it, maybe a little bit here and there. But if I need to try and convince you to come to privacy and you don't find it for yourself, the first second you hit a snag, you're likely going to drop it, forget it, stay, it's exhausting. You know, there's some people I've done some calls with where this happened to them and they're like, this isn't even worth it anymore. I'm like, well, why do you even begin? And it's like, well, I saw someone told me I should do it, so I did it, but this happened, I don't like it, so I just went back to my old phone and it just works. And it's, you know,
I definitely find that at least in my experience, and you know, those I know of who have made changes, if it's not organic, if it's not simple, then it's one of those things where like, too hard, I don't want to deal with it. And that's, you know, as much as people have their complaints with certain services like Proton and Tutor, like they work. They just work. More often than not, they just work. And if you want someone to shift to something private, more secure, then the one that works the simplest for the novice or the person who's just entering privacy, they want something that works. They want something that just works. Same reason, you know, we'll often, you know, suggest Signal as the alternative messenger is because it works. Just like WhatsApp. Just like Telegram, just better. And I think for majority of people, they want something that just works, and they've come to expect that things just work. And when, you know, companies and services that promote themselves as more privacy respecting don't factor that in, they lose a large majority of the population, I think. Because as you say, one small hurdle could be enough to stop people in their tracks entirely. They'll just say, yeah, I can't see this being worth all the extra effort. I'll just go back to Gmail. I'll just go back to WhatsApp or whatever, you know, platform they're using. And that's something that we all have to really consider more than we'd like to think, because, you know, as you say, we're kind of used to going through all these hurdles, and we've come to expect there will be hurdles, but we've already started running. What's a jump now over the hurdle when you've already started running? For the people who are still walking before they've started running, that hurdle is insurmountable.
Yeah, I have my list of complaints about Proton, but one thing they do extremely well is you can sign up, you can start using it, and now with their kind of business model of pursuing businesses, you have Meet, Documents, Excel, not Excel spreadsheets, but Sheets, Password Manager, everything's there, and it's all big buttons, easy to click, decent user interface. That's where I give them a lot of credit on going that route versus some other more privacy services. They don't do that. They lose people quick. Mm-hmm. Proton really kind of hands you that Apple experience almost, and one account for them all, for everything.
Yeah, I'd like to, you know, to be honest, I kind of plagiarize you and quote you quite often in one of your episodes. I wish I could remember which one it was off the top of my head, but you said, friction is the enemy of progress, which I think really aptly sums up that sort of concept. Like, if you're trying to onboard people into this, you have to make it smooth. It has to be almost a one-to-one sort of relationship or one-to-one corollary to what they're used to. And they just have to go, oh, this is easy to use and it's private. Cool. Move on.
Yep, exactly. Once they get in like that and it's just a smooth kind of sailing through, they'll run with it. They'll explore more. And yeah, just makes it a much better experience.
I do find like that sweet alternative option. It also means that, you know, the standard user doesn't have to go searching around for an alternative to what they're already used to. And that's definitely, as you said, that's definitely where Proton excels, I think. And in the fact that you've got everything you need there, and you can have some degree of guarantee that there's a sense of safety and privacy in that. And that really is what people are looking for. And as it's much like you, I've got my complaints with Proton, but they market themselves well for that very use case.
You pay one company and you get everything. You're not paying this service and this one, especially being subscription to death at this point. You're just paying one company, you get it all. And yeah.
Yeah. And I think Jay, you know, Proton is something that Jay and I have been talking a lot about lately, you know, definitely not trying to disparage them by any means or talk crap about them. But, you know, they do seem to be in the privacy spaces news lately as far as, you know, complaints that people are making about them. But Jay and I have often remarked that I think like one of the most helpful things that they've done to both of your points is that they've kind of created this really easy entry level. They've made privacy far more accessible. And I think I've met, you know, this certainly describes my own personal journey, but I've also met plenty of people who've started with Proton because it offers them all the basics that they need. And then as they advance through that marathon that we were speaking about earlier, a little further, they tend to compartmentalize and pick out the services that they just need from Proton. And then they'll get those others from other options, you know, whether it's Mulvad or Bitwarden or whatever.
Yeah, especially when, to me, there's like the big three of email, contacts, and calendar. Docs and stuff, okay, that's another thing. But Proton does those three very well. And once people find those, because it's the main question again in videos is, hey, I installed Graphene OS. How do I get my contacts on my phone? Okay, well, here's 10 different options. Do you want to self-host? Do you want to use this provider? Do you want to use this? Do you want to use Proton? Tuta? You know, it's so they kind of one size fits all. They just kind of nailed it.
Yeah.
And so we briefly discussed, you know, the future. At the end of your final episode of season 2 of In the Shell, you spent a little time reflecting on the future. What could you think could happen in the tech landscape over the next 5 or 10 years? How do you think some of the changes you anticipate from AI to subscription models, hardware, and cloud services will impact the average person as they pursue more privacy?
Ooh, average person. Let me think what that means. Yeah. So I've been happy that I've set up a lot of accounts, or I started my privacy journey, I'd say maybe 3, or I don't even know how many years at this point. But I've been glad I set up a lot of that stuff years ago, because I think a lot of the automated AI protections, things in place when signing up for accounts, financial institutions, different addresses. Now there's lists of VoIP numbers that are prohibited.
Mm, yeah.
Doing that stuff years ago was, I'm not gonna say much easier, but definitely easier. And I think AI and a lot of that stuff, they're now looking for outliers in the data during signup flows, things like that, is going to make it a lot more prohibitive for a lot of people to get into it. I think a couple months ago, I was looking to sign up for, I want to do a video on VoIP self-hosting. So I was looking to sign up for Telnex, was it the one, or VoIP MS? I had an existing account, so I could demo the video that way and show everyone how to set it up, go through it. But I'm like, yeah, it's not really accurate. Kind of going back to the beginning tutorial, kind of skipping the first 5 steps, then showing people the process. So I'm like, let me go through, set up a new account and talk about that. and I couldn't get past the signup process without providing my identity and scanning my photo and everything else. I'm like, okay, well, now this is prohibitive to do. I guess I'll stick with my pseudo. So I think things like that, we're going to start seeing happening more and more. Financial institutions signing up for accounts, they're going to vet your address more, vet your background information, things like that. Kind of building habits on you on the web is going to make it even tougher, I think. So that's kind of the negatives I see for people just coming about this.
I think I also tried something for VoIP MS at one point, and much like you, I could not get past that sign up without ID verification. And at that point, I was like, I have one that works. I'm not going to go through that hassle again. For a service, I'll be, frankly, I get fewer options and it requires more data. And in the past, my VoIP provider actually didn't ask for ID. They assumed, oh, you've got a phone number, you've got a name, you've got an email address, and that's probably all we need. As long as you pay us, we don't really care. In their defense, though, I did, however, port my old number, which obviously was KYC'd. So maybe they're like, oh, in the back, they're like, yeah, that's probably fine. They're probably legitimate. However, I'm going to throw it out there. I did previously test with that service when you could still do this, signing up with a number within that account, using the number I purchased through my VoIP provider to sign up for a new VoIP account, and that worked, no problems. And that was, in hindsight, I was like, that could so be abused. And now, obviously, you can't do that. You can't even recharge behind a VPN, which is insane. So it's even the small things like VPNs, the captures, the blocking of just IPs now is insane. Because again, they've got those lists, and now AI can pass through those lists to say, that's been blocked. We're not going to allow that. So it's definitely, I think AI is unfortunately where most of my fears lay for the future.
Funny, I guess it's also kind of a tangent too, since you mentioned the VPNs and blocking. One alternative that we might see come up, maybe this is just from what I've seen, I think it's a gray area too when it comes to privacy, but residential proxies, which are typically someone's router got compromised or they downloaded an app and they're quote unquote sharing it to get the service for free. Now you're just coming from someone else's house. Yeah, I don't really know. It's interesting future, I guess we could say.
To put it lightly, no doubt. Well, I think, you know, we're kind of circling around kind of the contours of the privacy discussion in terms of like how it's impacted by others who are not a part of the space yet, who are in some ways maybe unknowingly or unwittingly helping advance the surveillance model. And I think it's relatively typical to find people in this space, in the privacy space, who have found a community online because of privacy, but somewhat ironically, they're somewhat alone in their beliefs back in the real world. And I know you touched on this a bit earlier, but I'm kind of curious, how about your friends and your family? Have you gotten any of them to jump on the bandwagon?
Have I gotten anyone? One person in real life. The family still loves Apple iPhones.
Okay.
But all my main contacts are on Signal. So to me, that's
a win.
A huge, huge win, at least.
Yeah.
If we do video calls, it's over Signal. There's no more random text messages that way to my phone number.
Yeah.
But besides that, no, that's where I go back always to the, if they want to come to me, I'll assist them, you know, to the end to get them set up. But, you know, they watch my content to support me, but they still just use the conventional services.
As you say, if you have to twist their arm to join you in your crusade, so to speak, then it's not worth it. Much like you, I don't want to twist their arm, but if they do come to me, I'm more than happy to help. Like, I recently had a family member ask me about a VPN, which I'd suggest I link them to our episode. But afterwards, I was like, you know what, I'm just going to walk you through this personally, just so you know to do it right. In which case, they wanted to bypass a geo block for, I don't know, BBC iPlayer, I think. And afterwards, I was like, okay, I'm glad that worked. But again, you know, it's kind of at that point where they came to me for that advice, and I was happy to give it. And assuming this worked out well for them, I assume they'll come back to me again if they have another issue. And in that regard, that's probably the most encouragement one can give is, you know, they ask you something, you give them an answer, and it works for them. They're more likely to come back to you for assistance, which, you know, that they've experienced for themselves that it works, and it wasn't nearly as difficult as they thought it would be.
Yeah, that's definitely the biggest way to keep them going, keep them, you know, with it. And it's funny you mentioned it too, or asked the question initially, because people also ask me that. They're like, hey, you know, I just started with Graphene OS. I can't get my family to switch. No one wants to do it, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, welcome to the club. You know, if I can't do it and I put out the content, then good luck to you.
Yeah. Well, what's your take on the importance of that? You know, like, do you feel like it's important to kind of interact with the people that you think might be least likely to engage in this, to try to at least put it on their radar, make them aware of it in the hopes that that investment might pay off later?
I'd say once in a while, there's a few things where someone will come to me. I had some family members who, I forget what Gmail said or what Google said they were going to do with everyone's content on free plans. I think they're going to scan it for AI models. Mm. And they came to me, they're like, hey, I was thinking about signing up for Proton. I'm like, that's a great idea. You know, definitely, for sure, go for it. But other than that, yeah, I really don't tell anyone unless they ask about it.
Fair enough. It is a dense topic. Like you said, like if you're not totally willing to like immerse yourself in the learning of it, you probably won't have a lot of success.
Yeah, their eyes glass over and they're just like, okay, they're not even listening at this point. It's like, you know.
Definitely seen that happen a few times. I'll see myself going on about something and I can tell that they've stopped listening maybe 5 minutes ago. And I'm like, oh, that's on me. I should have noticed that this was a topic only I was finding interesting. usually it's occasionally, much like you, I might occasionally put something on their radar. Like if I know they use a particular service, I know they had a breach. I'm like, okay, just so you know, this particular service had a breach. Maybe be mindful of any emails you might get saying it's from that service or something. More like almost like a public service announcement rather than a do this, change this, be better, do better. Like it's a case of, you know, just be mindful this happened, just something on your radar, no push, no pressure. If they want to do something about that later, I'm more than happy to assist, but otherwise I'm like, just be aware kind of thing.
Yeah, now that you mention that, I do that with like my family's iPhone usage and things like that. You know, I'll see a newsletter or a blog post. Hey, iOS 18.4 just came out, has a bunch of 0 days that it patches for. Okay, send the text to the family.
Oh, nice.
Everyone update your phones. Okay.
Yeah. Well, we've certainly covered a lot. And before we wrap up, Josh, you know, I wanted to give you the opportunity to maybe say some final remarks and offer some newer listeners potentially some perspective or advice. What would you tell someone who's just getting into privacy now, who might feel a little overwhelmed by all the tech and all the language and all the tools that are available to them? What would you tell them to kind of help steer them in the right direction?
I'd say focus on the biggest and easiest wins first. So I mean, that kind of goes back to what we're talking about. Communication, who you're talking to, Signal, go to that first. Next one, email, another easy one. Besides that, contacts and calendar, those are the other two big exposures, at least I think so. So I would tell them to kind of focus on those four main things. And once you get that, it's kind of 80% of the way there. You know, there's always the smaller stuff. Yeah, your files, things like that. But just pick something, go with it. You can switch later. Stop trying to analyze everything. You'll spend months and months just deciding where to start, where to begin. You'll end up doing nothing and not even starting. So just take the plunge, try something, see if it works. If it doesn't, switch, kind of work from there. And there's a lot of noise out there. I'd say watch out for the noise. A lot of people have a lot of opinions. Watch out for opinions. Try to root yourself in facts as much as you can on what you're doing and have some concrete reasons behind it versus, you know, Josh at Side of Burrito said I should do it, so I did it. It's like, now think about it. Does it actually make sense? Then do it.
Yeah, stay clear from the flimsy reasons. Stick to the concrete.
Yeah, if someone's trying to motivate you through fear to then use their product, it's probably not the best choice. So that's one thing I always look out for. If you got to scare me into using it, you know, okay, let me give it the sniff test and see.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show. If people want to learn more about you or see some of your content, where can they head?
Best place for that, sideofburritos.com. Everything's linked down there, so that's where you can start.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Josh, so much for joining us. Appreciate you coming on the show and making time for us. And thanks to our listeners as well. If you haven't already seen or heard from Josh on YouTube or on In the Shell, go check him out today. And if you're pondering a podcast, definitely check out Yellow Ball. See if it's a good fit for you. And I very much am looking forward to trying out Salted Harbor. This will be fun.
Should be good.
Awesome. Thanks.